This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Craig Cohen. Okay, class, pencils down, put your books under your desks, and face the front. If you just shuddered, you're probably in some way still involved in the education system as a student or perhaps as a teacher. Yes, it's that time of year again. The buses are revved up and the back-to-school sales are in full swing at your friendly neighborhood stores. It only seems appropriate to take some time this week to discuss education issues. Our guest this hour, Illinois' outgoing State Superintendent of Education, Joseph Spagnuolo. As we talk with Dr. Spagnuolo, we welcome your questions and comments. The phone number's 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. Joseph Spagnuolo is a native of Virginia. He was named that state's top education executive in June of 94. Before coming to Illinois, he spent 4 years as superintendent of public instruction for Virginia. He was a school district superintendent for 17 years and also worked as a high school teacher, principal, and school business manager. In July, he announced plans to step down from the superintendent's post at the end of this month. On Tuesday, Dr. Spagnuolo begins a three-month fellowship at Governor State University in South Suburban Chicago. Joseph Spagnuolo, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you, Craig.
And congratulations on your fellowship.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. I'm really looking forward to that opportunity. I've had an opportunity to meet with the folks up there, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll do some good in the process.
Do you know yet exactly what you will be doing in your new job?
Well, there are a number of things that they have outlined and I have outlined involved. There will be some teaching involved. There's a public finance course that has been put out there, as well as an opportunity to do some writing and basically for 3 or 4 months to collect my thoughts about what we've been doing in Illinois for the last 4 years and what course of action we might want to take in terms of accountability and student assessment, standards, professional development for teachers, and issues along those lines. It's going to be a great opportunity for me before I step back into the real world again.
Is this your first time back into the classroom for a while?
Probably 25 years or so.
Wow. A long time.
Yeah. I've been a superintendent for that period of time, and although I taught a couple of graduate courses on an adjunct basis, I have not taught, in essence, full-time for a long time.
A little nervous about staring into students'
eyes? Yeah, I really am. It's sort of a big transition for me, you know. But it's one that I'm looking forward to with great anticipation. I'm kind of excited about it, actually.
Well, again, congratulations. As we begin a new school year, what are your, in your opinion, the major educational issues facing the state of Illinois?
Well, I think the educational issues facing kids and teachers and principals and superintendents and parents this year are pretty much the same issues that we've faced for a number of years, and that is how do we create a system that allows students, enable students to achieve at the highest level, comparable to any country in the world and certainly any other state in the union. At the same time, be accountable to the public that we're doing a good job and do so within the resources that we have available to us. So the challenge is to be sure that kids can read and write and do arithmetic and understand about how the country works and how the state works and how their local communities work and know science and be able to apply scientific principles. So the challenge is pretty much the same as it's been, I'd say, for the last half decade or so. And doing all of that in a rapidly changing world, a world that's based on information and technology.
One way to raise school performance standards is through standardized testing. I was wondering if maybe you could describe the IGAP test for those who maybe aren't familiar with it, what its purpose is and what it shows.
Sure. Basically, the IGAP is an acronym for the Illinois Goals Assessment Program, and it's a test that began in the late 80s basically as an accountability measure to determine how well schools are doing in comparison with other schools learning areas, 6 learning areas. Now, I think the more important issue is that we're about to change that dynamic markedly by putting much more emphasis on what individual students can do and making the test consistent with the academic standards that the board promulgated about a year ago. That is a watershed change, and one that will change the direction of public education in Illinois, at least in my opinion, for years to come.
What are some of the pros and cons of basing a student's general knowledge on the results of one test?
Well, I think one test or a test, or actually the ISAT is now being called Illinois Student Achievement Test, which was really a derivative of IGAP, but not exactly like it. It's actually not one test. It's a series of tests over an entire career, an entire academic career. The ISAT will be given at important points, for example, in the third grade, the fifth grade, the eighth grade, and the tenth grade, and there'll be an exit exam in grade 12, which is called the Prairie State Achievement Test. I see a lot of value in taking stock every so often in terms of what students know and what they don't know, not only for purposes of recording on permanent record cards, but also to be instructive to the teachers and to the school districts about where are the strengths and weaknesses in our curriculum, what aren't we doing that we should be doing. So I see it as a tremendous, on the plus side, a tremendous and powerful benefit. On the negative side, I think we have to be careful not to define education wholly by what appears on a test or what it may be in the standards. We look at the standards as minimal but not minimum expectations. Minimum but not minimal expectations. In other words, we want every child in Illinois, regardless of where they live, to achieve at a certain level. But we also want to enable them to go well beyond that point. And obviously, in a test of any kind, you can't measure everything. It's just not possible. So we have to be careful not to view it as the end all and be all, but as a baseline or a bottom line that we don't want anybody to fall below.
How do you determine what type of subjects to use, or which subjects to use on a standard test?
The subjects are really defined, or the areas are really defined in law. There are six of them: English, language arts, math, science, social studies, fine arts, physical development, and we've added a seventh, foreign language, which is really advisory in nature. So they're defined in law, and then basically what we did is we engaged about 28,000 Illinoisans in writing benchmarks about what's a good indication of whether a youngster at the third grade knows enough about mathematics to be sufficient. Can they add fractions, etc.?
What about those students who, frankly, just don't test well? You hear that from time to time.
Sure, you hear it. I have a tendency to believe that's a phenomenon that does exist. I also have a tendency to believe that it's relatively rare. It's not something that is the exception rather than the rule. For those students, we will have accommodations. Typically, those are kids who have learning disability problems of one kind or another. An accommodation may mean somebody will read the test to them. They may be given more time. It depends on what their disability happens to be or what their deficiency happens to be. But what we really want to get at is what the kid knows, and not in the business of proving what they don't know.
A popular criticism of standardized tests is that they can be sometimes unwittingly racially biased. How can Illinois protect against that?
That's a very good question. We do have a bias committee that's been in existence on the old IGAP and will certainly be in existence on the new ISAT. And the role of the bias committee basically is to review questions before they're given, so that if there is a question that reflects a bias, that would certainly be unintentional, because I think in this day and age, nobody would knowingly write something that was biased. They have the prerogative of saying, look, this doesn't work, let's kick it out, because we have a lot of items in the bank.
Are you familiar with Indiana's ISTEP test?
Only vaguely.
Do you know if it's similar to the ISAT?
You know, I don't know enough about Indiana's testing programs, no. Ours is based on a set of standards that were promulgated here in Illinois. I would presume that in Indiana's is the same.
Should a minimum score on a standardized test be a requirement for graduation?
In my opinion, yes. We're not here and we're not there yet in Illinois, but in my opinion, the exit exams can be very powerful in terms of driving curriculum and setting expectations. And I think that if we're going to reestablish the value of the high school diploma, we're going to have to be able to establish in the public's mind anyway that kids can do a certain level of work before they graduate.
Should that be true for each grade level then?
Well, I don't know if it's true for each grade level or not, but again, I want to emphasize that the ISAT is more than a single test. It's an accumulation of tests over a number of years. I would not necessarily advocate holding a child back in a grade because of their performance on one test. I would say that we need to make further investments, so to speak, not necessarily monetarily, but more in time, to be sure that kids can achieve at that level at those points, whether it's grades 3, 5, 8, or 10, because to pass a youngster on to the next level who doesn't know the subject makes no sense at all. All you're doing is leading to frustration and eventual dropout.
Some Chicago area students this year took some tests with questions of controversial material. Maybe you could explain how that transpired and what checks are in place to see to it that material on tests fits the standards of a particular community.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to are the questions related to the human sexuality and AIDS or HIV. That was really not part of the IGAP or ISET construct. What we did there is we developed a test bank of questions for school district to use on a local basis. The way we do that is we work in a consortium with 32 other states to develop literally hundreds of questions. Excuse me. And then each of the states is allowed to pick some questions to ask or to include in their local assessment. Unfortunately, the review process was not followed in this case, and the questions simply got out before they should have or got out when they shouldn't have.
And now, in the most recent goal assessment program test, reading scores going up, which I guess obviously is a good sign.
Absolutely.
Now, how does that stand in terms of over the last several years?
Well, they've been going down for a number of years, and now obviously reversed the trend, so that's good news for us.
And then also another bit of positive information, seniors beating the national average on the ACTs.
Yes, we're doing very, very well on the SAT benchmark, so we're happy about that as well.
Let's move on to another subject.
Sure.
That's also, another way to raise student standards, perhaps, is to improve the quality of instruction. Where do you stand on teacher accountability? Are our teachers good enough, and should we demand more from them?
Well, obviously, we feel like we have to demand much more from our teachers if we're going to demand more from our students. And we're in the process of changing the way that we educate teachers in Illinois and have developed a whole framework, if you will, in terms of how that should take place at the undergraduate level and also as a matter of continuing education. We have run about 9 pilot studies over the last year in various institutions of higher education in Illinois to see how we might go about this transformation in a reasonable way, in a way that can be used by other institutions. For example, Illinois State University might be doing something in math education. And we've supported that financially through the MacArthur Foundation to help develop ways to increase teachers' knowledge of content and also increase their ability to teach. Now, obviously, if that's a good model, we would hope that would be adopted by other colleges and universities throughout the state. So we're establishing, I think, a very strong track record in teacher education and professional development, just as we've done in requiring students to master certain levels of proficiency. We're also modifying the test that teachers take to make it more rigorous if they're going to teach in the public schools in Illinois.
All right, so then you're working towards statewide, stronger statewide minimum standards?
That's right. As a matter of fact, that work is ongoing now and has been completed in large measure, but there are still some pieces to get done. I think that the critical thing to remember, for the public to remember about that, is that for the first time in the history of Illinois, we now require teachers to provide evidence of professional growth before their certificate can be renewed. It's no longer get my certificate at 22 and I just don't have to do anything until I retire.
How can we help teachers to be more effective in the classroom? Is it a question of reducing classroom size or providing better materials or more funding?
Well, I mean, that's a broad question.
Yeah.
It's probably all of those things and more. Number one, I think a teacher should be well prepared in the content that they're going to teach. A position that we've taken is that we would like to see every teacher in Illinois eventually have a baccalaureate major or equivalent thereof in a subject, whether it's math, science, art, history, whatever it may be, so that we're absolutely certain that they are well-grounded in a subject to teach. No, it's insufficient to stay one chapter ahead of the kids, so to speak. That just doesn't make sense. Number two, any teacher who teaches in Illinois should understand and be able to practice how to teach. A lot of people say, well, anybody can teach, and that's just wrong. It's just as complicated and probably more complicated skill than being an engineer or an architect or a lawyer or whatever. And we need to hone those skills very carefully, and to be more specific, there's a body of knowledge out there now about how children learn. There's a body of knowledge about how adults learn. And we have to be sure that the teachers, prospective teachers, are well-grounded in that, because kids are different, just like grown-ups are. The diversity of our student population is becoming more and more apparent all the time. And as a consequence, if we're going to say, look, the content, our standards and the content are going to be high, then we have to learn how to reach these youngsters in a better way. Thirdly, we believe there ought to be a year-long induction program where a prospective teacher has the opportunity to work with a master teacher, if you will, for a whole year. I started teaching in 1965, which was a long time ago now, but basically I appeared at the schoolhouse door and the principal gave me the keys and said, go teach, and that's not an exaggeration, that's literal. We believe that that's patently wrong and a disservice to the kids. So that's one whole realm of things. Then if you slide over a little bit on the continuum of your question, if you will, the length of time needs to be modified. We're stuck with this 180-day agrarian calendar. That should change. Kids in other nations go to school far longer, 220, 230, 240 days, and this can't be a part-time enterprise. Thirdly, technology. We need to enhance. We've tried to do a lot of that in the last 4 years in Illinois. Is you have to change the dynamic. You can't take these kids out of rich technological environments in which they find themselves literally every place else other than the school, and we've got to create interactive kinds of things that excite kids, make them interested in learning while achieving the academic requirements that we have. Class size is an issue. It's not an issue across the board, but it's certainly an issue in the primary grades where kids are starting to learn how to read and do math. I mean, skill groups of 50 to 18 would be the maximum as far as I'm concerned. And that translates into money. I think we have to stop talking about needing more money in education and start talking about what the public's going to get in return for the dollars they do spend. And this business of needing more money to do the same is an archaic notion that I think the public is telling us over and over again is simply not playing well in Peoria, so to speak. And we've got to connect the results that we get to the dollars that we need.
You mentioned length of time as far as the length of the school year. Every few years, the debate comes up, should we just simply have school year-round period? What would it take to get to that point, you know, on a statewide basis? And is that something we should really seriously think about?
Well, I think we should seriously think about it, and I think it's a debate that's long overdue. The problem is the one that you quickly identified, and that's the cost would be astronomical. I mean, you're talking about adding, you know, considerable amount to already existing budgets, and that would certainly exacerbate a difficult financial situation. I would advocate a different approach, and the approach I would advocate is let's provide more time for the kids who need it the most. And those would be the ones on the low end of the test score continuum, if you will, or achievement continuum. And let's start there. If the idea is noteworthy and we do see improvement, then we move to it for other kids. But to simply extend the school year, for extending the school year, and do the same things over that we're doing now, would be a tremendous expense for probably little result. We have to modify what we're doing now. We have to deal with individual needs. We have to be sure that kids can get the reading, get the math. And if one approach doesn't work, let's use another approach. And if that doesn't work, let's use another approach. It's got to be a case of really paying attention to the individual needs of students. And frankly, that takes more time.
Now, granted, it was a number of years ago, but as a teacher, what did you see as the major hindrances for your ability to effectively instruct your kids?
Well, that first year, it was probably me. I was not. I didn't consider my preparation, or certainly my in school training, to be very effective. I believe a recognition of the fact that children are different, just like adults, and that we have to take into account those individual differences without lowering the standards, without making it easier or ordering the subject pen. But some kids have to learn best by manipulating, by having things to compare and to draw and et cetera. Others learn well just sitting and listening. So we have to take into account all the individual learning styles that kids have. And we can no longer commit ourselves to the fact that some kids are going to fail, because we can't afford that in this society. It's a very technological job market out there, and kids are going to have to learn to read and do math and understand computers and work with them if they're going to be successful. So watering things down doesn't pay anybody, do anybody any good, much less the kids.
We're right at the beginning of the next school year. How much time does it seem to take from, you know, one year to the next, at the beginning of the school year, just to review in the classrooms? How much time is spent on that?
Oh, gee, that varies so much. That's a hard one to answer. I'll make some generalizations. At the high school level, there's probably not much review at all, because that's a subject-centered or subject-oriented exercise for the most part, and you go from algebra to geometry. Obviously, there is some review in that context, but probably not as much as you might see in the elementary grades. And again, it would vary from school to school and teacher to teacher. In the elementary grades, I think there's a fair amount of review that goes on, particularly among those youngsters who don't have many of the advantages that some youngsters do. And that sort of harkens back to my comment about extending the period of time of schooling for those who can benefit the most, because there's a great deal of loss among poor kids in particular during the summer months. So a teacher might be well into October, or maybe even November, reviewing the previous year's work before they can really start new stuff. Now, all those statements are broad generalizations, and they may not apply in every instance, and probably don't, but just to give you an idea.
Before we leave the topic of teacher accountability, do you think salaries are high enough in Illinois to attract the best and brightest to education as a career?
No, I don't think salaries among teachers, not just in Illinois but across the country, are competitive enough. Probably more competitive now than they were, say, 10 or 15 years ago, because the job situation outside of education has changed so markedly. But I think it's unfortunate that, and I'm a big sports fan, when it takes 9 or 10 or 15 teachers even to make up the salary of a mediocre third baseman in the major leagues, there's something wrong. And it's just sort of reflective of the priorities we have as a nation. We advocate strong education, but when it comes time to putting our money where our mouth is, it often doesn't work. Now, there are a long history of sociological reasons for that are probably equally damning, so to speak. But by and large, teaching was a profession that was carried out by women, and in the days when women didn't have other opportunities open to them, they became nurses, teachers, secretaries, etc. If they wanted to go out in the workplace, and as a consequence, we got some mighty fine teachers simply because they had no other alternatives. Now that's not the case, so we have to be more competitive with surrounding professions, if you will, if we expect to be competitive.
Last week, Chicago Township High School District 214 administrators indicated that they're going to make a push to hire more minority teachers. Is that an issue of importance at the state level? Is there any consideration? Do we have an appropriate reflection of minority hires in our education system?
No, we're particularly deficient with minority teachers across the board. I don't recall the data off the top of my head, but you know, if say 17 or 14% of our students are minority students, my guess is minority teachers would only comprise 5 to 8% of the workforce. And again, you have the same problem there that you had with females entering the profession 30, 40, 50 years ago. Is now a good thing is that, you know, other job opportunities are open to women and minorities, and they're more lucrative, and they're heading in that direction early on. So, as a consequence, it's not we once had a captive audience, so to speak, among those groups, and that's not the case anymore. So it is a very big concern. I applaud Arlington Heights, I believe, is 214 for doing what they're doing. I think that's terrific.
We're talking with Joseph Spagnuolo. He's the Illinois State Superintendent of Education, the outgoing superintendent. On Tuesday, he begins a three-month fellowship at Governor's State University in South Suburban Chicago. And we welcome your questions and comments here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our phone number is 333-9455. That's in Champaign-Urbana. Or if you're calling from anywhere else, 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. We've talked a little bit about education funding. How would you suggest the state prioritize where money is spent? If you think about categories such as teacher salary increases or supplies or technology, where should the priority be?
Well, I really believe that the priority ought to follow the student, and the state ought to have its primary focus, and it does have this focus at this time, but I think it needs to be even more so, to equalize opportunity for those students that simply don't have advantages of any kind. Now, that is not to say that kids who live in the suburbs or other places shouldn't be supported well also, but you asked me specifically about the state. I think it's important that the state step in when the resources are meager and increase the level of funding to support technology or teacher salaries or materials or lower class size, etc. One of the things that we were able to do in the last General Assembly was establish an $83 million reading block grant program, which has it as its premise that schools and school districts will utilize that money to do those things that will benefit students the most in terms of achieving better reading scores and evidence of reading proficiency. Now, that to me is the kind of thing we ought to be doing because it's linking money or resources to an objective that we have, and that is improving reading. And I think you've seen some preliminary results that when we talk about things like this and put our emphasis on it, we get good response.
Now, sometimes the criticism is if you're looking at those more maybe underprivileged or impoverished districts and look at those students and try to find ways to maybe move more money that direction, one of the criticisms can be, well, if we're going to fund technology, that's great, and we've got these kids on the internet, except in this case, these students need clothes or hot lunches. Mm-hmm. And is the money really going to something that's worthwhile to that particular district?
Well, obviously, clothes and hot lunches are important elements. So it's hard to teach when it's hard to learn when you're hungry or improperly clothed. But in my view, as the institution of public education, we can do some things to help with that. I mean, we can provide breakfast, lunch, and supper, and in instances we do across the board. But that's not our primary role. Our primary role is teaching. And we have to find ways to maneuver around those natural impediments that strike us from time to time and teach in spite of them.
From a funding standpoint, is there anything wrong with the state paying for education using money from riverboat gambling or cigarette taxes or something like that? Are you ever concerned about where the money is coming from in the first place?
I am not. I'm reflecting on my own opinion here, but I'm not concerned about that at all. For example, the Illinois lottery proceeds from the lottery go into education. So, if you've crossed that philosophical barrier once, it seems like you can cross it again. I have no, as long as it's legal, ethical, and moral, I have no particular concerns about where the money comes from. I think it's whatever the best source is deemed by the General Assembly and the governor. I think that's what we ought to use.
One of the criticisms has always been that, when it comes to something like establishing a lottery in the first place is, okay, we know that the funding is supposed to go to education. Does it get there? And now that you're, when you're at that end, do you see the money coming in? Are you able to capably say, yeah, we got the funding, that we were told we would get, and that there's nothing disappearing along the line?
Well, one thing that's true in politics, whether it's Illinois or anywhere else, nothing or nearly nothing is as it appears to be. And although the lottery was sold on funding education, it's true that we receive lottery money, But it's also true that that lottery money is part of the bottom line, so to speak. So who's to say whether other portions of the taxing stream, so to speak, that would have come our way without the lottery haven't been reduced or increased or whatever. So it's a hard question to answer. My opinion and my guess is that probably we're receiving some potential percentage benefit from the lottery, but it's not 100%.
Where should the decision-making power come from for funding? Should it be a state or local issue? How much control should local districts have over how money is spent in that district?
Well, I think it needs to be a joint effort. It needs to be a true partnership. I know it's a trite expression, but it needs to be. Obviously, the system of education that we have established in this country, and in fact in this state, is predicated on both a local and state share. I think that needs to continue. There are those who espouse the concept of local control to the point of really not doing harm, more harm than good. The state does have a role. Education is a state responsibility, just like national defense is a federal responsibility. That doesn't mean the locality shouldn't participate, and some are better able to participate than others, and the mixture of state and local funds should depend on how wealthy a district is and how much they can raise on their own.
Well, what do you say to folks who say, you know, here in our district, whether this be the school board or a parent-teacher association, they say, look, we know in our district how best to raise our kids. We don't want the state involved in this.
I would say that they're probably wrong. I mean, to put it bluntly, it's true that they know most about their kids and most about their instructional practices or approaches or whatever. What I've used to describe that relationship is that the state ought to determine the how of education, the what of education. The state ought to determine what the goals are, what the standards are for everybody, so you have a uniformity across the state. But the localities ought to determine the how. How are we going to teach science? How are we going to teach math? What's the curriculum going to be? How many kids are going to be in a class, et cetera? I think those are things that ought to be determined at the local level. And I think in Illinois we've achieved a good mixture of that, a good balance with the promulgation of the academic standards and how local school districts are responding to implementing those standards.
Our guest is Joseph Spagnuolo, Illinois State Superintendent of Education, and we still have some time left to take your calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And we have a caller on line 2 from Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wonder if the standards are perhaps like requiring doctors to give every patient coming through the door a complete physical. It seems to me it's sort of overkill. You don't need information about all of those people except for a political reason. There are a good number of schools that probably don't need to do anything, and you're asking them to expend a considerable effort responding to this initiative that they could use doing other things that may be more relevant and more appropriate.
I probably wouldn't characterize it as requiring every patient to come in a doctor's office for having a complete physical. I would probably relate it more to patients who come in a doctor's office having their temperature taken or having their blood pressure taken, which are two things every time I go to a physician, both of those occur as a rule. Keep in mind the standards are really cast in academic terms. For example, there is a standard that says every third grade, and I'm paraphrasing now, will have to be able to add fractions by the end of the third grade. If a school or a school district is already doing that, and they're doing it well, and the students are achieving, then they need not worry about that standard. But there are school districts and schools in Illinois, probably in the rest of the country, where a lot of third graders are going on to the fourth and fifth grade without having acquired that skill. I think that's a mistake.
I think the number of students that you probably would identify that the local teachers and the local system hasn't already identified or tagged in some way, is probably, maybe even on a statewide, only a handful. That the amount of money that you're spending to alert systems to maybe just a handful of students is just disproportionate. I think it's an ill-advised use of resources. There are teachers, if you talk to teachers who have been promoted with their students, you know, in the systems where they put a teacher in, say at kindergarten, and have the teacher follow the students for third grade, those teachers often come back and say, I know the student knew that, and the next year the student doesn't know that. I know I taught that, and there are mysteries that the state just doesn't help by having this kind of test. The test isn't diagnostic. It isn't illuminative in respect to the individual problems that students may be having. And you are, you know, 5 years from now, people are going to look back and say, look at this grand reform. We haven't done anything. We haven't solved any problems.
Yeah, I would probably have a tendency to agree to a certain degree with respect to the diagnostic nature of the assessment. However, the assessments that are being developed to be administered the first time next February will be diagnostic in nature, and I think teachers can use them to identify deficiencies in reading. And for the first time, we're having subtest scores in vocabulary and word attack skills, etc. I think it's just a matter of really how you see it. I look at it from a statewide perspective, and I see hundreds and thousands of kids who go through our school system who the business community and others complain can't do this or can't do that. And I think the state has a responsibility to be sure that all of its citizens are as well educated as they can be. And, you know, the amount of money that we spend on education is huge compared to the minuscule amount that you spend on making a determination of whether kids are successful or not.
Let's go on now to line number 4, caller from Danville. Good afternoon.
Yes, you kind of covered it a little bit in the last caller, but like the education of the students, you know, what determines what they need to know, because what you and I might think be different from each other, because you hear these kids are getting dumbing down into school stuff, and they're always stupider than it was when your grandparents went to school.
Well, let me dispel that myth, because there's no empirical evidence whatsoever to indicate that kids are dumber today than their grandparents. As a matter of fact, I would put forward the proposition they're probably smarter today in terms of knowledge than they ever were, and that has nothing to do with school. It has to do with acquiring knowledge through reading books, television, etc. Keep in mind that we're not talking about things here that are out of the ordinary. We're talking about issues here like math and reading. I mean, regardless of how you want to approach it, kids have got to be able to write sentences in which the subjects and verbs agree. They've got to be able to just add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
What if you hear this? You say, my grandson has got awards in math. He's in the ninth grade. He's good, you know, got awards in math, but he can't make change. Can't spell with a hoot.
Yeah, your point's exactly what mine is. I mean, I think that you're exactly right, and that's where my concerns lie. I mean, you and I are in total agreement on that point. Not being able to make change, not being able to spell, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Let's go on to another call, line 1 from Kankakee. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. My question is this. What do you believe is the proper mix of tax sources to fund public education in Illinois? I think of property, which I think is grossly overtaxed for that purpose now, corporate income, sales tax, or maybe other taxes. What do you think would be the appropriate mix to fund adequately Illinois instruction?
Well, I can certainly express my opinion on that, but I want to stress it's only my opinion. It doesn't reflect the opinion of the board or the legislature or anybody else. I would say generally, and it will vary from district to district based on that district's wealth, I think 1/3 property tax and 2/3 income tax or sales tax.
I see. Thank you very much. Could I raise another question while I'm talking?
Go ahead.
Would you comment on the importance of teaching values to our students in public schools and how that might be most effectively done?
I think the teaching of values is extremely important. Matter of fact, our entire public school system for 200 years has been predicated on transmitting values from one generation to the other. The question that we run into all the time is whose values? And that's one that's very, very hard to discern. I would say, again, expressing my opinion, as a common set of values that are basically true to everybody. I don't care what religious creed or nationality or whatever. Things like honesty, integrity, trustworthiness, forthrightness, truthfulness, etc. And those kinds of values, I think, not only ought to be taught, but they ought to be emphasized in classrooms and in the home as well. I mean, where values should be taught to begin with is in the home by the mother and father or church or whatever the case may be. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen all the time. So I think schools ought to be constantly aware of that and constantly emphasizing it. Now, the difficulty, again, that you have with a value is there's no way to measure it. I mean, you can't say, you know, John is trustworthy and Mary's not. I mean, that's a hard thing to test, so to speak. So teacher judgment comes into play in a large measure there.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Let's try and get one more call from Rantoul, line 2. Go ahead.
Yes. I have a question on the state guidelines for class size at the high school level and also for special ed classes at the high school level.
Sure. I'm sorry, was that the question?
I believe so.
Yes, that's the question. I had one other question, too. State mandates that require funding may cause financial problems at some local levels. I'd like your comment on that.
Yeah, I think, taking the second one first, I think that's probably true. Again, going back to the mix of financial resources, I don't think you can have a conversation about financing schools without including what we're requiring, what the standards are, et cetera. But I would agree. We can cause a difficulty at the local level, particularly if there's not a lot of local wealth. I didn't quite understand the first question about class size in high school and special ed.
What is the state guidelines?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you.
Right.
In special education, there are guidelines spelled out in our state education plan, which has to go to the federal government for our federal resources, and it varies from one disability to another. Might be as few as 8 or 10 and as many as 24, depending on whether you're talking about learning disabilities or severely and profoundly handicapped or whatever. There are no particular guidelines in the high school level, at the state level. That's all locally determined.
Dr. Spagnuolo, we just have a minute or so left. I was wondering if you could quickly touch on the status of the job search for the new superintendent.
As I understand it, obviously I'm not directly involved in that at all, but as I understand it, the commitment is to find somebody as quickly as possible. I know the board's working awfully hard on it. I think a previously announced deadline of October 23rd has been modified somewhat to say, well, if we can find somebody next week, we'll hire him next week. If it takes us 2 months, we'll hire him in 2 months, or her, as the case may be. So I think it's progressing nicely. I think they have a lot of good candidates.
Any advice for your replacement?
Oh, gee, I don't know. It's such a tough job. I think you have to really feel your own way. I think the board's committed to continuing with the agenda that we put forth 4 years ago. I would say work hard and keep your head down. I believe in the credo, plan like you're going to live forever and work like you're going to die tomorrow. So, you know, if you do that, I suspect they'll be all right.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
That's Joseph Spagnuolo, Illinois State Superintendent of Education. And again, beginning Tuesday, he begins a 3-month fellowship at Governor's State University in South Suburban Chicago. Our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine.